Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, and I'm here to tell you about a really special event coming up in just a few weeks. We're going to have our 100th podcast episode, and we're doing it live, in person, with a studio audience. Everything will be live. We'll even be streaming it on the web live, so you can actually pull it up and listen to it as we do it. Yes, yeah, see how many flubs we actually make behind the scenes, and this time you'll get to see it live. That's going to be on November the 28th. Right now it's scheduled for 10:30 in the morning on November the 28th. There'll be more details coming about the website and where you can find it, and you'll be the first to know. So join us on November the 28th as we celebrate our 100th podcast. Thanks in large part to all of you that have been listening. Thanks, and we'll see you on November the 28th.
From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and we're so glad that you took the time to download us and you're listening to us this week. As we always do, we have fascinating and interesting people from the world of sports medicine and human performance with us, and this week is certainly no exception to that. We are so pleased to have Dr. Melinda Sheffield Moore with us. She is from Fight Nagy class of 1987,
whoop.
And she's returned home to do a talk here today, and we're so glad that you were able to take time to be with us today on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Tim. I'm excited to be here. It's always nice to come back home to Aggieland and see old friends.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. I want to tell the audience a little bit about you. Even though you started at A&M, you wound up doing a PhD in human bioenergetics at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, one of the meccas of exercise physiology research. Melinda is currently a professor of medicine in the Department of Internal Medicine in the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston.
Yeah, don't hold that against me. Sorry.
Not at all. Well, you know, we like our friends in Austin. We've interviewed a few of those.
Okay.
Her primary work is where she studies the effects of exercise, nutrition, and androgens on skeletal muscle protein metabolism in young and older volunteers and in cancer patients as
well. In cancer, that's right.
Yeah, Melinda is very well funded by the National Institutes of Health. And for just to give you a little bit more background on her, is she's one of those that helps set the national research policy because she sits on many of the review boards in many different places, telling the government if it's good science or not that people are proposing.
Right. It's lots of good science.
Yeah. So we're going to get started with a real easy question.
Okay.
Your background is in exercise science. Mm-hmm. How'd you get where you are? Some people may say, well, cancer's a long way from exercise science.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a long and winding tale. But essentially, when I left here, I was really focused on exercise. I wanted to do, exercise rehab type work.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a very limited attention span, and
many of us do in science, don't we?
Right. So I figured out pretty quickly that I wanted to be running the show. Mm. So the next step for me was I took a job at NASA, and at the same time I was working as what they called an experiment support scientist at NASA. I was working on my master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at U of H, and it was essentially an exercise science MED with Jim Pavarnik. I'm sure you know Jim.
He's been on the podcast.
Right.
He's Michigan a great guy. State now.
That's right. And so did that for a couple years, worked at NASA and trained astronauts to do physiology-based experiments in flight, and again sort of got the itch to want to do things myself and be able to control my own destiny. And at that time, Dave Kostel from Ball State was a NASA-funded scientist and had a spaceflight experiment. And Dave and I got to know each other really well by the fact that I was the one assigned to his particular experiment to train the astronauts on his experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit it off pretty well. He invited me to come do a PhD, said he'd pay for a PhD if I would come up to Ball State and do one. So at that time, my husband was just finishing his dental training, and so we decided to go up there. It was a big family decision because I was, you know, newly married, and my husband was just graduating from dental school and looking for his own practice. And so we made the move
to Muncie, Indiana.
And my husband struggled initially to sort of find a job, but I ended up very much enjoying my experience at Ball State. Dave Costell's a wonderful person, and of course got a chance to study and work with a lot of wonderful people that are you know, big names in the field of exercise physiology to this day. So it is a nice fraternity of folks that I worked with at Ball State.
Well, I mean, even up to that point, many people, if they had stopped right then, that they would consider that a career.
Well,
I mean, you got to work with the astronauts at NASA. You got to work with one of the more famous exercise physiologists
right.
of all time. And
right. I've been pretty fortunate, to say the least. When I left Ball State to come back to Houston, the decision was to find a place that my husband could buy a practice. Mm. It was his turn.
It
was his turn. And that's really, you know, it's a give and take, right? So we found a practice in the Clear Lake area right outside of Houston in the NASA Johnson Space Center area where we had been. We found a practice that he wanted to purchase. And Bob Wolf had, you know, most people know Bob Wolf in the field of metabolism. And I always had an interest in exercise and muscle metabolism. Mm-hmm. Certainly Ball State helped to foster that. So I went to Bob and said, look, I'm moving to the area. Do you have a postdoc for me? And he graciously took me in and did my postdoc there in Galveston in the Department of Surgery for 2 years and wrote my first R01 as an assistant professor in the Department of Surgery. And at that time, I was doing an NIH postdoctoral fellowship in trauma and burns. And so I was somewhat split between Bob Wolf's lab and Dave Herndon's lab. Dave Herndon is a burn surgeon. So I was doing a little bit of burn metabolism, a little bit of aging-related research. And about that time, UTMB got its first Pepper Center. Hmm. So with the Pepper and Aging Center that we have at UTMB that, you know, we've now kept in its second round, it was just a wonderful opportunity to start to do aging-related research. So I had sort of this forced clinical shift, you know, to studying trauma and burns. And then that translated to what I learned doing those studies into the older population with doing muscle biopsies, femoral lines, studying stable isotopic techniques for measuring muscle metabolism in these different populations. You know, with the clinical background and the fact that I had such a strong exercise background, I really wanted to move back into that. But I deeply loved doing the clinical research and couldn't see myself taking that step, you know, off track to leave clinical research.
Right.
So about that time, my primary collaborator that had been doing a lot of testosterone work with, Randy Urban, he took the chairman of internal medicine position, and he invited me to leave the Department of Surgery, come to medicine, and so I established my own lab and had an opportunity to continue my research with him, looking at supplementing hypogonadal older men with testosterone and looking at testosterone's influence on skeletal muscle.
And yes, because many people may hear that and they think, what, are you putting
right.
people on steroids and they're going
right.
to get big and bulky?
Yeah,
but
no.
It's really not just a strategy for helping older men in particular, in
right.
this case, maintain muscle mass.
Right, exactly. You know, unfortunately, as men age about the you know age of 50 or so, we start
Stop.
To...
Now you're making me feel old again.
Sorry,
okay.
sorry, Tim. about the age of 50, we start to see this sort of natural decline in endogenous levels of testosterone. And testosterone is important for a lot of reasons, which I'm not going to get into, but the skeletal muscle likes testosterone. The athletes figured that out a long time ago.
Right.
But if we replace hypogonadal older men with testosterone, meaning that we measure their serum testosterone levels and discover that they're low in the sense, then we can replace them with what we call replacement doses. So we're not giving super physiologic doses of testosterone trying to build up, you know, bulky older men. We're simply trying to provide them with the the natural endogenous substance that they've had, you know, mm-hmm. since day one. So that was the approach there. We had some nice funding through our Pepper Aging Center mm-hmm. to look at the influence of testosterone replacement in hypogonadal older men. And that work was, you know, one focus of my laboratory, and the other focus sort of led me, and I've always been interested in how microvascular blood flow or how skeletal muscle blood flow regulates muscle growth. Mm-hmm. So given that in the initial trauma and burns work that I was doing, nutrient delivery and glutamine synthesis, all sorts of glutamine metabolism in skeletal muscle was very important in burn populations. I wanted to be able to translate that to hypogonadal older men, to cancer cachexia, other areas where we have disease populations where muscle growth is important and muscle loss is detrimental. So,
right. Why is muscle loss detrimental? I mean, that may be a no-brainer for some of us, but there may be some in the audience going, so what?
Right. Well, the skeletal muscle is a huge reservoir, as you know, for amino acids, mm. and it's essentially what's responsible for feeding the body in times of in hard times, if you will. Mm-hmm. I'll leave it at that. So, in the case of, let's say, cancer, when the body has this onslaught of disease factors, so the tumor factors, the fact that they're inactive, mm-hmm. cancer patients are likely in some cases in bed or not very active. We know inactivity is detrimental to skeletal muscle. We know that tumor-derived factors are detrimental to skeletal muscle. So we then want to be able to intervene, if you will, in preventing some of these negative influences that can prevent skeletal muscle from functioning normally. And when skeletal muscle begins to break down, as you know, and releases these amino acids, it does a nice job of feeding other parts of right. the body, but at the expense of its own ability to function. And so in the case of cancer and burns and trauma and some of these other circumstances where muscle loss is either rapid or slower, if you will, in the case of some other diseases, it's important to intervene, whether it's a rapid loss or a more progressive loss like what occurs with aging. You know, the term sarcopenia, right?
Right, yeah.
The loss of skeletal muscle mass and function associated with age. And
I didn't realize that was an issue in burns.
It's a huge issue in burns.
Really?
It's probably one of the worst catabolic states of any condition. So it beats out cancer in the sense of skeletal muscle is rapidly taken away because of the fact that the burn is such a hypermetabolic scenario.
Wow.
So heart rate's rapid, breathing is rapid. You know, you lose your skin, mm-hmm. and essentially everything leaks out, if you will.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. you know, there's this the acute phase protein response. So where are you going to go for that? The muscle is the primary feeding organism to handle that. So muscle loss is very rapid in those circumstances.
Wow, didn't realize that was an issue.
Yep.
Now, certainly in a burn issue, you're usually under really supervised care in a hospital and so forth. But oftentimes with cancer, especially with aging as well, this muscle loss may happen. You don't realize it's happening.
Right.
And especially in cancer patients, what are some things that you recommend people to do to help maybe prevent some of that muscle loss?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring that up because in cancer, often times the loss of muscle mass and the weight loss is what actually takes that person to the doctor in the first place.
Mm.
So I've noticed I've lost 20 pounds in the last 3 months, but I'm not trying to lose weight.
Right.
That's not
the weight loss program you want to be in.
No,
is
it's
it?
not yeah. at all, not at all. But it is that first indication often for some patients that don't realize that they have it because they have no other obvious signs. So it's certainly takes them to the doctor, and it's one of these things that you want to be able to quickly intervene in. In cancer, there's something called a performance status. So when you treat a cancer patient, in order to be able to provide them with therapy such as chemotherapy and radiation, they have to have a certain performance status. And if they don't have this magical number,
right.
Which indicates that they're in good enough health to sustain the treatment,
mm-hmm.
then they can't receive the treatment. So The performance status, one function of that is their skeletal muscle health. Mm-hmm. So if you can't perform activities of daily living, if you can't bathe yourself, feed yourself, cook your own meals, things like that, then you're not well enough in many, you know, in the eyes of this performance status and how that's viewed in cancer therapeutics, you're not well enough to receive treatment.
Wow, so you got to pass a test to be able
you
to receive
pass
treatment.
The test to receive
physical
treatment.
Test.
Right, exactly.
For all those of you that didn't like PE in school.
That's right.
Let's hope you don't have cancer.
That's right. And frankly, exercise is you know one of the top line ways to do that. I mean, nutrients and exercise.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we start there. We tell those patients, we know you're fatigued. We know that you don't feel well. But you need to get out and walk. You need to get on the treadmill. You need to get on your stationary bicycle. It's important to get the muscles moving. It's important to get blood flow going. And then we recommend particular nutritional interventions. Mm-hmm. It's important that they maintain their protein intake because mm-hmm. protein is what feeds the muscle.
And, well, that was a question that we had was, are there additional nutrient supplements or a specific diet they can do to help that?
Well, what we recommend is that, and I'm not by no means am I an RD, but what we recommend from the research that we've done in amino acid and protein metabolism and skeletal muscle in trauma and burns and cancer, what we recommend is that they, if they don't feel well enough to eat the caloric volume that they need throughout the day, that they preferentially take in protein. Mm. So that's where we start, and that's a very basic message to these patients because many of them would rather try to eat a bowl of soup or some rice or something like that. Eat a piece of chicken.
Yeah.
Frankly, that's going to be better for the muscle than choosing something like ice cream or soup or something like that. So.
Yeah.
We do give just some basic nutritional advice, but if we're going to mix cancer and aging, we know from some research we did several years ago that most people think of cancer cachexia, and what drives cancer cachexia is the breakdown of muscle, so muscle loss.
Mm-hmm.
We get this increased breakdown rate, and muscle starts to go away, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we did a study in a group of ovarian cancer patients a few years back that showed that these patients do have the potential, or the anabolic potential, if you will, when they take in nutrients to increase their muscle metabolism. So muscle growth does take place like it does in you and it does in me when we eat a meal. Muscle growth occurs if the right mixture of protein is in the meal.
Right.
So what we showed was that essentially if you have cancer, that you have that potential, but it's not as great as it would be in a healthy person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's blunted to some extent.
Right.
So the anabolic potential of that skeletal muscle for amino acids or protein is blunted.
Mm-hmm.
If you add age on top of the factor of cancer, it's even worse.
Wow.
So age plus cancer is worse than cancer alone in the sense of how muscle responds to nutrients that you take in a meal.
Bad combination.
Bad combination.
Wow. What about resistance training for cancer patients?
Well, we recommend any type of training, exercise training, that we can get our patients to do. We don't have them go into the gym per se to do heavy lifting.
Right.
But anything that stimulates muscle blood flow is a good thing, and we know that resistance training is anabolic to skeletal muscle. It just comes down to what can you get your patients to do and what do they feel like doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And more often than resistance training, most of the patients would rather go for a walk or get on their stationary bike rather than going to the gym. To do resistance training. But interestingly, those patients that start out at a really low activity level, we end up seeing that once we get them to the point where they're able to be functional again, so they get out of bed, they feel like getting out of bed, they're up and exercising, they're taking care of themselves, cooking their own meals, that sort of thing, going to their doctor's visits, we see that then they seek out activities like resistance training.
Mm.
It's this fresh new leaf, right? They've turned over this new leaf. They're now ready to start doing the things that they hear from the lay press is good for their muscles. And
right.
certainly resistance exercises is.
Yeah.
So.
Now, one of the things we try to do here is we try to humanize science, because science sometimes can be this institute that no one understands. And you mentioned working with human patients. There
right.
are always funny stories that go along with working with people in the lab setting, and all scientists aren't boring geeks. So what is your funniest lab story?
Well, I told you I couldn't tell you the funniest one,
okay.
but I'll tell you a nice one. We like to liven things up by playing practical jokes. And one of my primary collaborators, Doug Padden-Jones, when I was an assistant professor in Bob Wolf's lab and he was a postdoc, and Doug was new to UTMB, and he was still trying to figure out his way. And he needed a car, because we're on an island, right? And
right.
if you want to go anywhere, if you want to get off the island, you need a car. So he had just purchased this new car, and Doug is a bit of a practical joker himself. So if you know this guy, he's constantly playing jokes on people. He'll leave like fake roaches in my ice cream and things like that. So he was long overdue for a practical joke. And he was in the office one day, and I had a buddy of mine who is a flight instructor and was an HPD patrol detective at that time. Had him call Doug and tell him that his new car was going to be impounded because it had been needed to be seized because it had been in this drug seizure by the DEA, right? And that they had sold it to him, and they shouldn't have sold it to him, but it would have to be impounded and seized for probably about 3 months, and that we hope this didn't inconvenience him. So my friend called him, acting as a police officer, as he does, right? And I happened to walk into the office as this phone conversation was taking place. I was actually too late. By the time my friend got off the phone with him, he was already on the phone with the dealership yelling at the guy who sold him the car. So I walked in and was giving them the stop sign, this really isn't real. And he gives me this perplexed look, and I said, April Fools. So he had already gone out to clean his car out. He had already taken a trip down, pulled out all his CDs and all the other stuff, thought that they were rounding the corner to seize his car. So it's nice to have friends
that can
help you play practical jokes.
Yeah, yeah. Don't want to get on your bad side.
No, you don't want to get on my bad side. So.
We're running short on time here, and so as we always do every week, we'd like to wrap it up with a take-home message. So what do you want people to remember from this podcast?
Well, it's going to be a boring take-home message and probably not the one that most people want to hear, but even in the clinical world of disease and aging and cancer and the like, if I look across, how we intervene to prevent muscle loss in these particular populations, the primary way that we do that is with exercise.
Mm.
And, we all tell people to exercise every day, but I think when you realize that even in disease states and disease populations that it's our primary therapeutic target, mm-hmm. it really is a take-home message that even if you can just do a little bit of exercise, you need to get out there and do it, because you never know when you're the next cancer patient or age sneaks up on you and you look down and you have no leg muscles anymore.
Right.
So get started now.
Yeah,
so.
Or you can't see your feet.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or you can't see your feet. So
great take-home message.
Yep.
Thank you for being with us today. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Well, you're more than welcome. Anytime you want to come back, Aggies are always welcome.
Yeah,
right?
Gigam Aggs.
Yeah. And I want to thank everyone that's listening for taking the time to download us and listening. And as we do every week, we have a podcast question for you. And here with the podcast question is Kelly.
What is one of the first indicators that initially sends cancer patients to a physician?
Nice question. So be the first one to email us the answer to that question, and you can send that answer to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. And if you're the first one, we will send you one of those nifty podcast t-shirts. And hurry up, because the second edition is running low as we speak. So, again, thank you, Melinda, for being with us.
Thanks, Tim. Enjoyed it.
You're welcome. And thank you all for listening. And we hope that you join us next week for another interesting individual or person in the world of sports medicine. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.